So some more ideas on practice. One of the hallmarks of Lompa Cha's training is the idea of frustration. So he felt that sense restraint was very important. So what we're doing, we're practicing sense restraint here, we're not distracting ourselves. But also frustration, when it's applied judiciously, has an interesting effect. Because when we can't get what we want, or when we get what we don't want, those two, we want something, we can't have it, we don't want something, it doesn't go away, then that wanting really challenges us. So we're frustrated, desire is frustrated. So when you're, let's say, if you're doing walking meditation and you want to leave after 20 minutes and the bell rings in 45 minutes, desire arises. And there's nothing wrong with that, it's not evil or anything like that. But in the arising of desire, the mind is seeking some other experience, right? You want something else, a cup of tea, and this experience is now boredom. So then the idea is, if I get another experience, and somehow I'll be happy. But then if you notice, I'm awake to that feeling of, this is boring, and I stay with that with awareness, then the boredom has a chance to process through, and the boredom ceases, and then the peace of the mind is the resultant of not seeking another experience, just being with this experience. Whereas if, and that peace of the mind is a kind of centering stillness, silence, which is no longer dependent on the time of day, on the length of the meditation path, on the number of minutes you're walking. If you don't do that and just, if I just, every time I feel, well, this is boring, I want to do something else, the mind is always going out into objects, thoughts and ideas and cups of tea and talking with people and all the rest of it. So in the frustration of desire, if it's done mindfully, desire is known as an object, one doesn't attach to it. One sees the desire as an object, and as the desire ceases, you begin to experience peace. And that's one of the parts of understanding how a retreat works. So I'd really encourage noble silence. You know, this is very, very helpful, because sometimes we feel lonely or bored or whatever, and then we engage and talk with each other. Now some talk is necessary functionally just to get stuff done and so on, and or we joke around a bit, but just the kind of need we have maybe to have a long discussion, it can be quite interesting. But to actually look at that need for social contact, that need to go up from the heart, and if you look at that and you're aware of that as an object of mind, then that need falls away. And so, I mean, classically, you've probably heard many stories of Ajahn Chah where he'd give 4, 5, 6 hour Dharma talks. And he would just repeat the same things again and again and again and again. And the whole room was ready to kind of jump him. You know, this wonderful teacher, well, after 3 hours it's not so wonderful. And he would, you know, you could see he was playing with us. I had one, actually, Ajahn Jan, which is another one of his senior disciples. We had done an all-night sitting. Okay, so we had sat from, we'd done sitting, walking, meditation from 7 in the evening till 3 in the morning. Then we had done a long morning chanting. Then right away we had to go on alms round. We came back in alms round, which was, got back maybe 7:30, had the one meal of the day that was around. So we're finished by 8:30, and then Ajahn Jan calls us into the meditation hall after all this. So everyone's totally whacked, totally tired. Right? And so Ajahn Jan gets up on the tamat, the the Dharma seat, and he starts giving a Dharma talk. And I mean, hardly anyone's even had their head on their shoulders. It's just, and he starts to give his Dharma talk. And, you know, everyone was kind of, knew he was playing with them, but still, you just wanted to go to bed. You know, this is ridiculous. And then the mind would think, this is ridiculous. People should be awake for Dharma. What's he doing? And then this was brilliant. Then he kind of stopped. And then I go, oh, great, we're out of here. And then he started again. And then he stopped again, and then he was on a higher seat, and he put his foot down onto the bench to step into a bench where you step up. You know, and as soon as you saw that foot go down, oh, great. And then he started again. He did this 3 or 4 times until you just saw, give up, Veerdhamma. It's all right. You're only tired. And he kind of would frustrate desire in that kind of playful way, and he'd say, well, what's the real problem here? Well, the problem is he won't shut up. That's the problem, right? The problem's out there. And then because he was so playful and actually quite loving in this, you could say, no, the problem's my mind. I want things to be other than they are. Ah. Now, if it was cruel, you know, if he was being kind of abusive, then you're out of there. That's just not on. But that wasn't the case. And he had the authority and permission, really, to kind of do that. And it was actually quite kind of him, because it's very difficult to sit there when 40 men are hating you. It takes considerable courage to do that. So we don't, usually in culture, we don't try to frustrate desire. Consumer culture, of course, is just trying to satiate desire. But can desire ever be satiated? Huh? Really? So here, you know, you have the posture, and you have like a situation where you sit for 45 minutes according to this clock. Yeah, if my knees start to hurt, then my first thought is, I'll ring it early. You know, I have the power, right? Now, if I believe in that, if I don't see that with discomfort as condition, there's the desire to ring the bell. You can't do that. You can only leave. So maybe that is your kind of consideration. But that's the thought that comes into consciousness. So with painful knee as condition, this thought comes up. Well, if I rang it, fine. You know, I'd kind of get out of the pain. And the pain isn't that. It's just, you know, discomfort. But then the next time, it'd be the same thing, wouldn't it? The next time, then maybe after 10 minutes, and then I think, oh, 10 minutes, it would look bad if I rang the bell after 10 minutes. I have to go longer. And the mind gets very, very complicated. But if I then just see the desire to move away from discomfort, I'm just with discomfort. Discomfort feels this way. But not in a way where you hurt yourself. You can move your body, you can leave if you want. You always give yourself permission for that, just as a way of understanding pleasant and unpleasant, because this is part of our human predicament. So discomfort is unpleasant, and so, oh, unpleasant feels this way. Then you're coming home again to know the mind as the mind. And if you bear witness to that, eventually your mind comes to a sense of what we call emptiness, where it's no longer a sense of me trying to do something to alleviate the discomfort. There is just discomfort as an object, and there's a tremendous peacefulness in that, because there's no longer the sense of self-identity with the discomfort. You're not pushing it away, but you're not identifying with it. And that takes a lot of patience. You just have to witness to this whole sense of self, how it arises according to craving, how it comes up into the consciousness. So the structure of the retreat and these sittings kind of gives you a chance to do that. Yeah? And it's voluntary. No one is forced to do it. So there's a sense of the frustration of desire in which you can understand desire. But the other aspect of a retreat I come from monastic life. I come from a place of training, and that's my take on Buddhism is an idea where of training mind and body. Training for what? Well, training to create a foundation where there's so much stability in consciousness that the transcendent can be realized, the unconditioned, the unoriginated, the unformed nibbana can be realized. And that takes a tremendous kind of stability in consciousness. And where the instability arises in the preferences to pleasant and unpleasant. The mind's always moving, pleasant to unpleasant. So part of the kind of methodology, I suppose, of a retreat is this sense of not now being able to distract, not having any compensations. So if you usually feel, if you're bored, you go to the fridge, have a yogurt, kills the boredom for, you know, a minute. You don't have that now. Boredom arises, restlessness arises, oh, it feels this way. You come home. You come home. There's a friend in Perth, in Ontario, and she has a sign on her fridge, "It's not in here." That's very good for her. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is also like the aspect of craft. And the aspect of craft is the idea of training. And say, if you've ever baked a loaf of bread, you get the mixture of flour and water and salt, etc. And you knead it, you put the yeast in or whatever. And then you let it rise and then you bake it. Now, first time you baked a loaf of bread, probably it came out, but you know, usually it doesn't work. It doesn't rise properly, rises, you know, all over the oven or whatever it does. But as you do it, as you learn how to knead the dough and you know how much yeast to put in and the temperature and you learn about your stove and what kind of flour you're using, etc., etc., you become a good baker. And that's a craft, isn't it? And how is that craft learned? It's not learned by reading a cookbook. The cookbook gives you a kind of entry into that craft, but then it's the doing. And then the doing becomes quite physical, quite visceral, quite intuitive, because you do it. And that's practice, and that's what we're doing. The image I like is the craft of the heart. We're learning about how consciousness works, what leads to peace, and what leads to confusion. What liberates the heart from suffering and what brings the heart into suffering. And that is both insightful, but also that what is involved is a kind of training and development of very good qualities. One of the qualities you really need to develop is endurance. One has to learn to endure. Certainly this was with Ajahn Chah, was one of the kind of constant refrains we'd get as Western monks, because we came to the monastery, our minds were not trained, we weren't skilled in samadhi, and my life had been pretty sloppy, really, just kind of doing what I wanted to do. And so because the mind wasn't trained, I'd go to Ajahn Chah, my meditation doesn't work. He said, well, what do you expect? You expect your meditation to be all of a sudden bright and sunny when you haven't trained the mind? And then he'd say, endure, watton, watton. He would say that all the time. So that's a kind of foundation strength, or what we call paramita, the capacity to endure discomfort, to endure boredom, and just to witness it. So as I was saying last night, just like my struggle with fear, is it wasn't just the struggle of fear, it was also developing like positive capacity to bear witness to endure, to be patient with something which was unpleasant. So all of that, so it wasn't just a kind of understanding of my karma, but it was also understanding how to train the heart with this particular karmic formation which I was working with. So see that also, it's like, you know, you're training in very, very good qualities in on a retreat, developing very, very wholesome qualities, even though the experience itself might not be fun. You know, sometimes you have a kind of difficult period in meditation or in your life, and you bear witness to it with courage. And then although it is maybe unpleasant, because you've now been the witness rather than been the subject of this whole thing, you've endured it, you've watched it, you come out of it a much more mature, peaceful, conscious being. And that's different than just having pleasant experiences all the time. It's a kind of mature thing. So with all that in mind, let's just stretch your legs a bit, and then I'd like to do that heart practice again as a training. Let's use the same kind of patterns that I spoke about yesterday. So the awakening, so if you like, just use that kind of suggestion of listening. Again, why I use that, I find that listening brings me to a kind of receptive, attentive state of mind. So again, non-becoming, I'm not trying to get an experience. I'm just with this experience of listening. Non-aversion, I'm not fighting any of the sounds, just the way they are. And then non-distraction, trying to realize a sense of no thought. So to listen, you have to let go of thinking. So that letting go of past and future. And then the challenge is sustaining that clarity. So one of the things we do is use our posture. So go to your posture and feel the grounding of the body on the chair or on the ground, and just get it really stable, something which is well balanced. So it's good to give time to the posture. So well balanced, not too much weight on one side. So feel the weight of the body on the ground. Is there more pressure on the right or the left? Does it feel even? And then the spine's very important. So initially I find it good just to stretch the spine. And open the chest, stretch the spine upwards. Sometimes you hear the vertebra crack. So you really get a kind of good stretch and open up, and then let the posture settle into something nice and tall, open. So your belly's open, your chest is open. This can be very helpful. And then the breathing. Feel the breathing in the body. Welcome the in-breath. Let go of the out-breath. Then feel the breathing at the center of the chest. The breath comes in at the center of the chest and leaves. Make the breath nice and full, so really feel it in the beginning. So you're in the body, not just in an idea. So welcoming in, letting go out. Now bring to mind the image or name of a friend, someone who, when you think of them, partner, child, whoever, when you think of the person, it's very easy to feel kindness and empathy. So name the person and then draw them into your heart. with the breath. And out breath, may you be well. So you're connecting to something that's always there, a sense of kindness. So the breath calms, and the imagery and the intention opens the heart. So rather than having a whole series of thoughts, you use one thought, the name of the person on the in-breath, and then one sentence on the out-breath. You just repeat. So that it engages the thinking mind just a little bit. It's like giving to a person that this whole, your whole energy is devoted to their well-being. So you're not trying to get some kind of hard experience for yourself. Then change the image, bring up someone else, maybe someone on the retreat if you want, someone who you find has been helpful. So the image of the person and the name, and hold the image and name for the whole in-breath. So if I would say Ajahn Tir Dhammo for the whole image, the whole in-breath, Ajahn Tira, in our breath, may you be well. So that you sustain that intention and for the whole in-breath that calms the mind. May you be well, calms the mind, that kind of sustaining. And then the attention at the heart really opens the heart. Again, take another person. The changing the image helps just to refresh that intention. Visualize them, name them. Hold that image for the whole in-breath and the out-breath, may you be well. Then bring yourself into the practice. May I be well. Somehow to imagine this person sitting here. May I be free in the out-breath. So you're just filling your whole being up with kindness, non-judgment, non-critical, everything about you, all your flaws and whatever you think of your body or your mind or your emotions or your history, you're kind to the whole, all of it. So may I be well, may I be free. So it's uncritical, totally inclusive to all of it. So then, so a useful pattern is to take three or four people, including yourself, and just cycle through. And then after a while, you don't really need the imagery. You just get a sense of the open heart, welcoming the breath in there, breathing out. And then it's just this beautiful kind of open-hearted breathing, one breath at a time. So because it is a craft, you should have to play around, try different images, see how it works, like baking the bread.